Hey, this is Rex from Pantera and Down. You're listening to Icon Fetch.
Welcome to Icon Fetch, the web's premier music interview show. Now, here's your host, Tony Peters.
Primed and ready to go for another edition of Icon Fetch. And this time around, he's a keyboard player, a guitar player, a music director, producer, multi-instrumentalist, Jim McGorman, who's currently on the road with Avril Lavigne, jet-setting around the world in support of her new record called Goodbye Lullaby. Jim is probably best known as a member of the house band on both seasons of the TV show Rockstar. He's also played with a host of other people as well, and in addition, he makes his own music as well. So lots and lots to talk about here. Want to welcome to the program Jim McGorman. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So this whirlwind tour that you've been on with Avril Lavigne, it seems like you've hit some pretty much like, you know, all points on the globe, right?
Well, we just did a 5-week first promo run, and we actually did kind of go all around the world in about 30 days. So it's been kind of crazy, but really fun, actually. It was a great first run back. You know, we had been off for a few years with Avril while she was making this record, and so it's kind of fun to be back in the swing of it.
Well, and I mean, I'm looking here, Paris, London, Monte Carlo, Hong Kong, Tokyo, you know, you guys have been all over the place. I mean, do you get a chance when you're in those cities to actually do a little sightseeing, or is it a whirlwind kind of thing?
Well, this time, we had a lot of time. When you do promo, usually the band has much more time because the artist is doing interviews, and is much busier, and we're kind of more based out of cities.
Okay.
for days at a time, whereas when you're on a tour, you know, you do a show at night and then you're off to the next place the next day. So on a promo tour, you're usually kind of in a city for a few days, and we had an amazing amount of time. Actually, the band was pretty light, and we really got to see pretty much everything, which was amazing. So it was really fun, and we got to do some touristy type things.
Sure, absolutely. And speaking of which, you know, Avril Lavigne, she's hitting the road now for the U.S. sort of leg of the tour. You guys are currently sort of in the process of the talk show circuit, and from what I understand, you guys did the Tonight Show, and for you personally, this is like old hat for you, right?
Well, you know, it's never old hat,
right?
But
right.
You know, I think it was my 12th time on the
show. Wow, unbelievable!
We figured it out last night, and I think that was number 12. And I was kind of joking with some of the crew, because a lot of the people that were there 10 years ago when I first started playing on that show are still there, like the stage managers and the behind the scenes people that run that show. A lot of them are still there, and I jokingly said, "I said, look, this is Baker's Dozen, and if I get to 20, I want a chair spot. like I want to sit in the chair,
right.
And I want to be
right."
So,
and this isn't just with Avril Lavigne, right? I mean, you're talking all kinds of different artists, right?
Yeah, I think it was my third time with Avril, and I actually just texted or emailed with Michelle Branch last night. She still holds the record. I was on 4 times with her.
Okay.
And I think this was my third one with Avril. So,
okay.
Yeah, it was just a kind of a grab bag of stuff. And, you know, over the years, I think the first one was in 98 with the New Radicals. You got the music in you. Don't let go. You got the music in you.
I happened to be looking on the Twitter page last night, and it said something about you filling in for Avril because she wasn't feeling so well during soundcheck. Is that right?
Wow, you're doing your research, man.
Well, I just happened to check the website, and I'm like, oh, look at that.
Checking out the Twitter.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing is, as a singer myself, the thing that I think that kills the vocals more than anything is the talking. It's not necessarily the singing. If you're singing correctly, you should be able to sing for a while and be okay. But like I said, she's doing all these interviews and press, and that's really what kind of runs you down, in my opinion. So she's been doing so much of that, and plus with the flying, and when you're dealing with the air conditioning in airplanes, the filtered air and all that, it dries you out a lot. So you have to be really, really conscientious about keeping the throat, you know, okay, and, you know, kind of warmed up. And so I think she's just a little bit strained on her voice. We all kind of are. But when we do these shows, you know, a lot of times they want you to do a few run-throughs in sound check and then a few run-throughs for cameras. And by the time, you know, if you get there, you know, 10 in the morning, you do it 5-6 times, it's a lot.
Right.
So sometimes she'll just have me sing it, and and she'll be sipping tea in her dressing room,
right,
and laughing at me on the video monitor.
Right. So so is there, you know, some private footage of Jim McGormick singing What the Hell then, huh?
There may be. I don't know if they were actually rolling, but trust me, if there is, you don't want to see it. That song is way out of my range.
I love
it. I can sing parts of it.
Right.
But, I mean, Avril's voice is, you know, it's incredible range, and, you know, the chorus is just in the stratosphere.
Right.
I can barely get it in falsetto. And it's not pretty.
right, exactly. With beat, you play rhythm guitar, you also sing, but from what I understand, you play a lot of instruments, drums, keyboards, that kind of stuff. Has it come in handy? I mean, you talk about Avril being sick and you sort of stepping up during the sound check. Had there been other instances where you're like, oh, man, we need a keyboard player really bad here, you know?
Well, you know, actually, the funny thing is, the piano is my principal instrument.
Okay.
I started playing piano when I was about 6 years old, and my father's a piano player. That's really my first love, instrument-wise. And I went to, you know, Berklee College of Music, and my principal instrument, you have to choose an instrument that's your principal, and that was my instrument, was piano. So I started playing guitar when I was, like, 12 or 13, but it was more for the girls, really. you know, I would go to these parties when you were a little kid, and you know, if the place didn't have a piano, I was out of luck, and there'd be always be some kid in the corner with an acoustic, you know, strumming, and everybody'd be crowded around. And, you know, growing up in South Jersey, you know, right across the bridge from Philly, you know, Bon Jovi was a big thing at the time, and Springsteen, and they always, you know, were guitar players. So
right.
From a songwriter perspective, and, you know, kind of a rock star thing, I was like, oh, I gotta play guitar. So it's funny because in certain circles, people don't even realize that I play piano, and excuse me, and that's kind of was my principal instrument. It's just kind of by happenstance that I've worked as a guitar player for all these years. So of course, I play piano and keyboards in a lot of instances. But there was a kind of a funny instance where I was working with Weezer about a year or so ago, and you know, Rivers, the lead singer, he's an eccentric dude. He's awesome. He's an incredible musician. And sometimes he wants to try things that are different, and I think sometimes he enjoys playing and working with musicians that may not be virtuosos on specific things. And so we were working on something, and he was doing some covers with a string section, and he was doing Coldplay's Viva La Vida.
Okay.
And they didn't have a drummer at the time, and we the other guys in Weezer were kind of away from the rehearsal studio because Rivers wanted to kind of be more acoustic vibe, and we realized that we really needed a pulse, you know, something to kind of keep the rhythm going. You know, string players notoriously, no offense, are not, you know, the most on their own rhythmically solid bunch because they're used to playing in a lot of free time. So there was a drum kid in there, and he said, well, you know, we both agreed somebody needed to play drums, and I just happened to be there. So, you know, I sat behind the thing, and I pretty much just hit the kick drum for a while and then started adding in a couple other things. And I always assumed that when Pat showed up that he would play drums. And River said, no, we're going to keep you on the drums. And so I ended up playing a couple songs at a show in New York with technically Weezer on drums. It was kind of me and Rivers and some string players and a piano player. So it was really fun.
Oh, that's great. And you were listed as like the musical director for Weezer. What does that sort of job entail then? What do you do as music director for Weezer?
You know, the term music director is very broad, and mm-hmm. it is confusing to a lot of people. And in certain instances, it's almost a kind of a specious title because, you know, if you're in a rock band, you know, really, is there a guy to, you know, musically direct everybody? But, you know, I've been a musical director now off and on in bands that I've been in for, you know, ten years, and it's really different in every instance. Sometimes, you know, they're looking for someone who obviously has a broad musical sense and can discuss parts with every musician and kind of basically, you know, you have a producer in the studio, and then you have to translate everything to a live environment, and someone has to run the ship. And a lot of times, the lead singer or the star, you know, A, they're busy, B, it's not that interesting to them to, you know, kind of oversee everything, and they just want someone who, when they're not around, to kind of run the show and say, okay, we need to get through these songs here, and we need to get an intro for this, and we're going to go from this song to that song, and we're going to construct the set this way. And just, it's basically, in my opinion, a lot of times it's having, like, it's basically being a producer for a live environment. But, you know, a lot of it's a psychological game, and, you know, you kind of have to, you know, make sure everybody's feeling good. And you know, look, when you're in a band, whether it's a real band or a hired band, there's always, you know, egos and personalities to navigate. And music is a subjective thing, so there is no right or wrong answer to any, you know, one musical question. And, you know, it can get feisty at times. So you really have to have someone to, you know, look to for the final answer, I suppose.
No, and I mean, that makes sense. That's something you never really think of. You just think, okay, well, there's a producer in the studio, and they're just going to do it live. And you just sort of take it for granted that will be very easy to do, but that's not always the case then.
Right. Well, especially now, you know, with the way that records are made, I mean, a track could have 80, 90, 100 some tracks going on that we don't, as a listener, you're not really sitting there picking out, okay, well, there's, you know, four guitar parts, and there's, you know, six keyboard parts, and there's all these percussion things going on, and backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to figure out a way to kind of do that with four or five or six people, you know, sometimes, or sometimes even less. And, you know, it's become very in fashion to run tracks and, you know, basically be playing along to the record. Weezer doesn't do that at all. And Avril does very, very little of that. Just basically, you know, if there's some songs that have specific drum, you know, loops and such, we will kind of run those sounds because that sound, you know, isn't necessarily the sound coming out of a live drum kit. So there's different ways to do it. But, you know, I'm fortunate to be in some situations where there's still 95% of it is live playing or, you know, even more than that.
Right. No, and that's old school, and that's the way it should be, I think, so.
I like it. I mean, the thing is, you know, when you rely so much on a box, whether it's, you know, Pro Tools or Ableton Live or any of these programs, you know, just the percentage of something going wrong increases dramatically the more you rely on those kinds of things.
Yeah, and you get the Ashley Simpson moment on Saturday Night Live or whatever.
Exactly. And we just, you know, we just don't want that.
Right. No, absolutely. I'm looking at all these different people that you've collaborated. I mean, you know, you mentioned Michelle Branch, you know, Mark Broussard, Tal Bachman. You know, you've got, you know, Goo Goo Dolls, Poison. And then I see, you know, Cher. Do you have a good Cher story for me?
You know, I think I do have a good Cher. Actually, I do. I have a nice Cher story.
Okay.
I love Cher. She's going to be aces in my book forever because of this story, I'll tell you. I had started working with her at the end of 2004, and I was basically just filling in for a guy who ended up becoming a great friend, and we worked together on the rock star shows, Paul Mirkovich. He's been working with Cher for 20 years, and he had something he had to take care of off the road, and he needed someone to fill in for a little bit. It was supposed to be, you know, a month or two, and it ended up turning into about 9 months or almost a year in a span between 2004 and 2005, and I played, you know, keyboards for her and sang a duet. Which was the song called After All, which she had done with Peter Cetera.
Right.
Oh,
okay.
It's a great song, and it was an honor to be able to do that. And so, you know, towards the end of the run, it was her farewell tour before we knew she was going to come back and play in Vegas. And actually, what I hear, she may go out again.
Right. So, yeah.
But it was towards the end of the run, and she had a few shows coming up at the Hollywood Bowl. It was like the last two or three shows, and there was about a week or so remaining, and I always had known that Paul was going to come back for the very end because he had been with Cher for so many years, and he didn't want to miss, you know, if it was the last time she was ever going to play, he didn't want to miss that, and I completely understood, but I had also kind of grown to be a part of the band and the family from, you know, for being out there for 9 months, and so it was about maybe 3 weeks before the tour was ending, and the managers called me in, and I assumed they were going to say, hey, okay, well, Paul's going to come back, and we're just going to ship you home. And apparently the way it went was, well, Paul's going to come back, and we're going to send Jimmy home. They told Cher, and she said, well, doesn't Jimmy play guitar? And I had never played guitar with her, and they said, oh, yeah, I think he does. And she said, well, just put him on guitar. We're not sending him home. He's going to finish the tour with us.
That's cool.
So I thought it was incredibly classy. And I was basically a superfluous band member for the last 3 weeks, just strumming away on acoustic guitar and singing the odd background here or there. But she said, look, he's been with us, and we'll have them both out. So I thought it was unbelievable, and we ended up working together again at the beginning of 2009. I did a little run with her in Vegas, and so she's great.
No, that's a great story, and just, you know, and it's what an opportunity too. So,
well, my mother was really excited.
Sure, exactly. I can see that. Well, you know, and I noticed that Paul Stanley. You worked with Paul Stanley as well.
Yeah, that was one of the greatest little runs. You know, I grew up listening to Kiss.
We all did, I think. Yes.
You know, I was Ace Frehley for Halloween when I was probably, I don't know, 8, 9 years old,
right,
and maybe even earlier. And you know, I had the Kiss dolls and the whole thing. And I remember getting a phone call. It was towards the end of the second season of Rockstar, and I got a phone call from him, and someone had given him my number, and he said, hey, you know, I've been watching you guys on the show, and I'm looking to put a band together to do, you know, a couple months in support of this record. He hadn't done a solo record in like 20 years,
right,
or something.
Yeah.
And so he put this record out, and, you know, they called me, and then he said, well, why don't I just, you know, get the whole band, because you guys are great. So we all did it, and it was awesome. It was like so great because I got to play Kiss songs with the lead singer.
Exactly. Right.
It was a pretty powerhouse band. I mean, that band was an amazing band, a rock star house band. And so, yeah, it was a special thing. You know, it was really awesome. Very short-lived, but pretty great.
And let's talk about that, the rock star band. You know, you had two seasons and two very different seasons. You know, one was INXS. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the other one, you've got this sort of all-star lineup of guys, you know, with Gilby Clark and Tommy Lee and Jason Newsted and that kind of thing. And but I guess there is a difference between having a great band and having it right for TV. You find certain times where it was like, okay, you were cooking as a band, but there were certain things you had to modify for the television audience?
Well, the challenge with that was, you're working with such a range of singers and singing ability and range, like within their range, that a lot of times we'd have to change keys on songs that, you know, we've heard in the original key for years. And, you know, as a guitar player, a lot of times, you know, the key is very specific to how you play the song on the guitar, whether it's open strings or, you know, power chords or you know, using capos, etc. And so a lot of times if, you know, let's say a girl was singing a song, we'd have to take that, you know, a male song, we'd have to take it up, you know, a lot. And then sometimes we'd have to take it down in key. And that was probably the biggest thing that we kind of noticed musically that was a challenge, to kind of, you know, adjust keys of songs for these different singers and have it sound great. Because, you know, the key of a song is very, very important. I think it's taken for granted a lot that you kind of get the key right. But you gotta, you know, for that's part of the reason why a song is or isn't a hit, you know, if you're hitting that sweet spot for the singer. So that was part of it. And then also the time constraints. I mean, we were doing songs, you know, I think it was like 55 seconds or, you know, a minute and 20 seconds worth of a song. So that was a big challenge as well, to kind of take a song that we all know and have heard a million times, and we have to condense it into, you know, 70 seconds,
wow,
90 seconds, 2 minutes. And so you're cutting out intros, you're cutting out parts. And we had to learn, I don't know, 15, 20 songs a week at least. It was really challenging, and it was great, though. It was kind of like musical boot camp all over again.
Right, absolutely.
I think we did 150 songs each season. So,
wow.
Especially for me as a guitarist, it was great because, you know, I've never really taken a guitar lesson. I mean, I kind of taught myself how to play guitar, and, you know, as you know, I can read music. You know, I don't do it a lot, but you know, I can obviously read charts and all that, but I can read as a piano player. But it was great to kind of go through the history of all those songs and just have to learn them and listen to what the guitar players were doing sound wise on the records. And I think it immensely improved my abilities, and I think I was definitely a better player after those shows.
In addition to all the stuff we've been talking about, you also write and record your own music, right?
I do. Yeah, you know, I moved out to L.A., I don't know, 15 years ago, and I told my mother I'd have a record deal, you know, within a couple months. It's funny how that works.
Right.
But I never really actually thought that I would be, you know, be a sideman or, you know, musician to the stars, you know, if you will. I just thought I was going to be a singer-songwriter, and I'd be in a band or something and maybe play on some records. But, you know, so it's something that I've always done, write songs, record them. I signed an indie record deal in the beginning of 2008, and I just signed the exit agreements on that a few months ago. It was one of those situations where someone I had known for a little while had, you know, recently become the president of an indie label, and they had always wanted to work with me, and we signed a little deal, and you know, it started out okay, and then just got weird, and it ended up not working out as far as the label and me. But it wasn't a terrible experience, and I ended up actually getting some great songs written out of that process, and I'm kind of still in the process of figuring out what I'm doing with them, because we kind of have an entire record almost completed, and it's pretty much just sitting on my hard drive. So I'm trying to find the, you know, the time to, you know, flush it out and see which songs will work, and maybe just kind of release it on my own at this point.
No, that's cool. And if people want it, do you have the songs up on your website or MySpace page, that kind of thing?
I have two records on iTunes, and there's a lot of music on my website, jimmcgorman.com, and which is J-I-M, and then another M, C-G-O-R-M-A-N. And, you know, there's a record under my name, Jim McGorman, called The World is Falling Down, which is on iTunes. If this world is falling down, and then I also have another side project called The Awesomeness, which is was really fun, kind of synth pop 80s retro style. I miss those 80s days, I miss those 80s days, when everything was fun and everyone was young. It's not full out committed 80s, but there's a lot of 80s synth influences on it, and that's something that I actually I'm doing with two of the other guys who are in Avril's band, and another a woman who's a great singer-songwriter named Michelle Featherstone, who's had success on her own. And we just started writing a bunch of songs for fun, and you know, kind of went that way in the studio. And I came up with the name The Awesomeness. We had done a show at the Viper Room in L.A., which was a tribute to John Hughes. After he passed away.
Right, the Breakfast Club guy.
And band together, yep. And did all songs from his movies.
Oh, wow, that's cool.
We did like an 80s night.
Right.
We had people dress up. It was actually a really successful night, and they've asked us back. We're trying to figure out a way to do another night. But, you know, that's music that I grew up with, and I still enjoy it and love it today. I love the songwriting and, you know, and the production, so... So that's on iTunes as well. It's called Inside Your Head is the name of the record. It's the 8-song record under The Awesomeness.
Oh, that's cool. Well, Jim, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Good luck with the continuing publicity tour with Avril Lavigne, and good luck on the new music of your own stuff too, man.
Thanks, appreciate it.
Yeah, interesting guy there for sure. Jim McGorman, he does Facebook and MySpace and Twitter and jimmcgorman.com. And look around on the TV if you see Avril Lavigne playing live. Look to the left or to the right there. You may see Jim playing guitar. A versatile guy, and that's how he's still in the music business now. So that's what you got to do these days for sure. Coming up on Icon Fetch, we will be talking to the lead singer of Big Head Todd and the Monsters, Todd Park Moore. They have a tribute to Robert Johnson, a great new CD out called 100 Years of Robert Johnson. Glenn Phillips, the lead singer of Toad the Wet Sprocket. These guys are hitting the road in the summer. We'll find out what he's been up to. Damon Johnson led a band called Brother Kane back in the 90s, and he's got a great new solo CD called Release. Also, Scott Sachs was in a band called Wanderlust in the 90s, but more recently, he wrote a Grammy-winning song for Faith Hill and Tim McGraw. Larry Harris is the author of a new book called And Party Every Day, the behind-the-scenes story of the Casablanca Records that was home to Kiss and the Village People and more, so we'll talk to him. Also, John Oates, one half of Hall & Oates. John has a solo CD out called Mississippi Mile. The Meat Puppets, alternative band that jammed with Nirvana on MTV's Unplugged. Meat Puppets have a new disc out called Lollipop. We talked to Kurt Kirkwood. We'll be airing that interview. And also, Grateful Dead fans, David Lemieux, who is the Grateful Dead's tape archivist. We'll sit down with him and talk about the mammoth 72-CD box of the Europe 72 tour from the Grateful Dead, and that'll be coming up real soon as well. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Icon Fetch with Tony Peters. Want more great interviews? Head over to iconfetch.com. There, you'll find every interview we've ever done, plus CD reviews, This Day in Music, and a random album of the day. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Who is Tony going to interview next? It could be you. Send what you've got to Tony Peters. Icon Fetch, P.O. Box 292134, Dayton, Ohio, 45429. Or email Tony at host@iconfetch.com. Until next time, this is Joe Kelly. Have a great day.